this time it wasn't, you know, just joy, but it was also a lot of anger. And it was also a lot of, I have to do something about this. I have to join the fight against this because this is slaughter.
Welcome to the Inner Instinct podcast. I'm your host, Angie Tiwari. And in each episode, our guests will be sharing their three moments of instinct. These are three defining moments in their lives when their instinct showed up and how that impacted them, depending on whether they listened to that intuition or not. I hope that these conversations break down the barriers to understanding your inner voice, help you believe in your instinct, and ultimately honor your deepest wisdom. We all have a gut instinct, the clarity of which depends on how much we choose to listen. When you do, I think you'll be astounded by how much your life can transform. It all starts with noticing the inner voice and listening to your deepest needs. This is what I call the inner instinct, and now is the time to unearth yours. If you haven't already, please hit the subscribe and follow button. It makes a huge difference and means we can continue to share the power of energy and gut instinct. Thank you so much for all your incredible support so far. Now let's get into it. Welcome, Karishma. Thank you so much for being on the Inner Instinct podcast. I would love for you to share a little bit about yourself for our listeners who aren't familiar with you and your work.
Hi. Thank you, first of all, for having me this morning. My name is Karishma Porwal. I'm a 25-year-old climate activist, climate educator, environmentalist. The list goes on in terms of ways that we describe ourselves. But I think I'm still evolving when it comes to my career, when it comes to my interests, when it comes to my identity as someone who exists in the climate space. But that is what I've kind of crafted my life around. I have lived in many places, but I was born in India, and I am very closely connected to my heritage as a South Asian woman. Currently, I work at a nonprofit in the sustainable finance space here in Ontario, Canada. Before this, I used to work in the traditional corporate world before I realized that that was not in tune, it was not aligned with my values. And so I made a big pivot in my career to try and make it merge with my values and my passion and my moral compass last year. And so I've been on a journey, and I found that along the way, I've met a lot of interesting people, learned a lot of new things. Right now, I'm pursuing my master's in sustainability leadership remotely from Arizona State University. Yeah, I mean, I used to describe myself as my career, my job position, and my education. But I've felt like these days I want to go beyond that because we are all so much more than our LinkedIn labels and our resumes. And so for me, you know, I, outside of work and outside of school, I love gardening with my dad in the summertime. I love thrifting specifically for books and for art because I get really excited when I find something new. I am a big swimmer. I love going swimming. I used to be a competitive swimmer when I was younger, and these days I prefer more so open water swimming. Big outdoors girl. I like going outside, hiking. And even if it's not hiking, just being outside and enjoying whatever season we're in. Like right now in Canada, we are experiencing a pretty harsh winter. And so I'm trying to make the most of that by going outside as much as I can, no matter how cold it might be. And yeah, I think I try my best to get involved with my community when possible, connecting with people in my immediate local area and understanding what are the issues and needs of my community and how I can play a role in that. So that is kind of who I am outside of my professional life. I have a little sister. I have a Doberman named Zara, who's a handful, and I'm very grateful to be where I am.
That's lovely. Thank you so much. The way I like to start these episodes is with a check-in around how you're feeling today. This is really designed to help you go with your instinct and go with your gut, because a lot of the time we have that first instinctual feeling of how we're feeling, but we want to suppress an emotion or we want to turn it into a more positive one, even if it isn't. So this is an opportunity for an open and honest check-in. When you go with your instinct and you go with your gut, how is it that you're feeling today?
Thank you for asking, first of all. I guess I don't feel 100% just because I had to wake up really early to drive my parents to the airport and I slipped on the ice outside. And you know those days when you just take a bunch of L's and you're like, okay, I'm not going to exhaust myself trying to fix everything that's happening today. I'm just going to let it come as it comes. And I'm sure like it'll calm down by the evening. And I also don't drink coffee, right? Like I try not to drink coffee. I do if I need to, but right now I'm trying really hard not to drink coffee. And so I feel like I should have some coffee right now, but I'm trying not to. I'm trying to just stay awake by going outside, being in the cold, having some tea, staying on my feet. But you know, it's a little bit of a struggle. So I feel like I'm not 100% today, but I'm still very grateful to be here, very happy to be chatting with you and excited to talk about the topics that we're going to delve into today. It's just, if my voice sounds a little, why does she sound like she's tired? It's because I am.
I love that though, because there's so much almost toxic positivity sometimes, especially in the well-being industry, which is where I work. But it's so important to share the times where it's like, yes, you're on a podcast and having a chat, but you don't feel 100%. And that's also okay, as opposed to it having to be, yeah, I'm good, thanks. And then we move on. So I'm glad we could start with this honest check-in. And you mentioned there you're excited to get into it. So we will get straight into it, moving through your three moments of instinct. So three times in your life where you felt that gut instinct, that intuition within you, and what has happened when you have listened to it, what has happened when maybe you haven't listened to it, and what the outcome of each of those scenarios was. We're starting with your first, which is about seeing a mother and calf humpback whale in the Caribbean Sea. I'm so interested to learn more about this. Tell me more.
It was one of those moments of just happiness, joy, that I hang on to almost every day. I think about that moment because right after I purchased this whale tail necklace that I wear every single day just to remind me of that moment that brought me so much clarity and just joy. And I felt just exhilarated. I felt ecstatic when I saw those whales. I mean, I have been a big, big fan of animals since I was a little girl. And that comes from my dad, who grew up reading The Man-Eating Leopard of Rudraprayag. He grew up watching, you know, forcing me to watch David Attenborough and all the other Disney documentaries about animals, about nature. He's actually expressed to me many times that if he didn't end up a doctor, he would probably be an animal photographer, just like sitting alone in the Himalayas waiting for a snow leopard to come out. And I have always had that vision of him in my head, even though it's never happened. And so I guess he nurtured that side of me that had a real interest in wildlife. And my grandpa, his father, he bought me this encyclopedia of animals when I was younger. And I read that book front to back maybe 3 to 4 times. And there was a section on whales and other animals in the whale family that I was most enchanted by. I think that it was their sheer size, the fact that they were mammals just like us, the fact that, you know, mothers breastfed their children just like us, the fact that they gave birth to live young just like us, but they're so massive and they live in the sea and they can hold their breath for hours at a time. And I think I just felt like they were magic. I felt like they weren't real. It was almost like, I'll believe it when I see it type of things. And so I had gone whale watching a couple times. I'd actually been whale watching in England, hadn't seen anything, just saw a seal. I had been whale watching in Quebec, hadn't seen anything. And so to me, they just became this elusive creature that I was destined to never see. And then when we were on vacation in the Dominican Republic, we decided to go whale watching again. And I think my hopes were not so high at that time because I guess I hadn't had much luck before. And so I was kind of just sitting on the deck of the boat, looking out into the open ocean and just waiting for it to be over almost, because I felt like I was putting myself through torture, just wanting to see this animal that I had waited to see. It felt like my whole life. And then out of nowhere, my poor mom, she gets seasick and I forced her onto the boat with us. She was not feeling well. And I was already feeling so guilty for having dragged her on there. Out of nowhere, we see this massive, majestic female adult breach out of the water, fully out of the water, and enter back in. I thought that I had thought it up in my mind. I thought I hadn't seen it. And then I realized everybody else on the deck was like rushing over to take photos. I felt like I actually lost my breath in that moment. And, you know, I was just watching in awe. It felt like I couldn't hear anything else around me. Felt like I was just so hyper-focused on this whale. And then we saw her baby jump out too. And I just felt like I had tears in my eyes. And I wanted to go and grab my mom because, you know, I saw this whale and her baby, and I wanted to go grab my mom. I'm her baby too, but she was not feeling so well. But either way, I was like tearing up and I was breathless, and I felt like, I don't know, I felt almost like I was on a natural high after that moment. I hadn't felt anything like that before. You know, full disclosure, I'd never done any drugs at that point. Like I'd never, you know, I wasn't much of a drinker, and I had never felt this like sort of actual exhilaration where I felt like I was walking on air. I was so excited. My dad, with his camera in his wildlife photographer element, was able to capture a few photos of the mother and the baby. I think that's one of those moments where I felt, you know, just joy. And I felt like this creature that I'd been waiting to see my whole childhood was manifesting in front of me, and that nature in all of its majesty is there. It's just that sometimes we don't see it. Sometimes we can't find it. I think it's one of the pivotal moments that led me to be such a steward and have such a, I guess, bold voice when it comes to standing up for the voiceless, because there are these huge creatures that are much bigger than us, much older than us, and have seen much more of history than we have, that are now at our mercy, and yet they don't have a voice. And I feel like that was one of the moments where I felt like it's a responsibility to speak up for those that don't have a voice. It's a responsibility to protect what's been around for much longer than us, something so silent yet so graceful. I think it was a defining moment in my journey as an environmentalist.
That's so beautiful. And I was wondering where you were going with seeing that incredible sight, and then how that linked in with your instinct. And it's amazing how you've taken away something so beautiful in nature, and then something that has inspired you to make a change in your life for not yourself, but also for the wider community. A lot of us miss that. You mentioned earlier you love gardening and being outside and how much joy that brings you, but also look at how much of a change we can make in our future off the back of what we see. And I think a walk in the park is so different when you're on the phone chatting away or really in your head thinking about a problem. But a walk in the park, looking around, observing nature, and you might see a bird that you've never seen in that park before because your eyes haven't been open to it and your mind hasn't been aware. They're two very different experiences.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that like one of the biggest elements of the climate crisis is that we don't see it. Many of us in the global north, we don't really see it happening around us. And so we don't believe it. Humans by nature are so short-sighted. And that's nobody's fault. It's just the way that we are. We all dealt with COVID so quickly because we saw this problem unfold in a matter of months. But the climate crisis is a slow boiling pot of water. And we are all frogs in that water. And if you've ever heard that phrase that, you know, if you throw a frog into boiling water, it's going to jump right out. But if you boil the water slowly while they're in there, you will boil the frogs alive. And like, that's us, right? And I think that for me, seeing that whale was like seeing this mythical creature that I knew, you know, some scientists had seen it, some wildlife photographers had seen it, but I'd never seen it. So I didn't believe it. Believe it as in, yeah, I knew it was out there, but I just didn't believe how truly awesome it could be to see it, how truly big they were and how powerful they were. And it came into clarity for me when I was there in person. And it made me realize that actually there's little things around us that are changing. And if we start to pay attention, we'll see them. And that's a huge part of the climate crisis, but also a part of connecting with nature. Because once you connect with something, care about something, you're so much more likely to become a steward of it. And I think I've been trying to practice more of that in my life, that I don't need to go and see my favorite animal, which is a whale. I don't need to go out onto a boat and, you know, see this creature to feel that fire in my belly every day. My dad and I, we always say that there's always a day in Ontario here in March, just one day where all the birds come back. We feel like after a long winter, suddenly one day you'll just hear chirping and you'll see all these chickadees and you'll see the cardinals against the snow. One day they're all just back. And that day, funnily enough, just happened like last Saturday. So 2 days ago for us, where we went outside and we were like, okay, the birds are back. They're all back. Like, they're all just here. And I feel like maybe it's a gradual thing. And it's just that we've now tried to mindfully and consciously go out there and notice that they're back. But for us, it's like, okay, it's bird day. They're back now. And I feel so much joy when I see the birds come back. So we go out and we spread some bird seed over the snow, and it almost marks the changing of the seasons for us. And I feel that it's so healing almost when you connect with the things that are happening in the physical world, because we are often so caught up in what's happening in these digital worlds that we've made up of social media, of the economy, of banking. As important as it is, we do tend to forget what's going on in the forceful, the majestic physical world around us. And once we connect with that, we feel the importance of what really matters.
Absolutely. Ayurveda believes that we are part of nature. Ayurveda is a spiritual science. Ayur means life, and Veda means knowledge or science. So it's the science of life, the science of knowledge. And it's really about how we are part of the universe and we are part of nature. But we as humans get so within our heads and within ourselves, tied up in our own lives and the dramas within that, that we forget that. And we don't see the similarities between ourselves and a bird, between ourselves and a whale. Like you mentioned earlier, there are so many similarities there. And then it feels so distant to us. It feels so unrelated. And then it can feel like not worth caring for because we are so inwards, but sometimes inwards, not in the right sense of that word. Inwards to our detriment, perhaps, rather than inwards for our own spiritual growth. I completely agree with that. And my father-in-law, in fact, both my in-laws are extremely into birds. And I've learned so much about birds over the last 4 to 5 years. And I have a huge appreciation. And since then, I have seen more birds. Like I see them more because I'm aware of them and where they are. And I keep my eyes open for them. And then you have these magical moments. I saw a barn owl the other day in my local park in London. And then 2 days later, I saw a kingfisher, again, in my local park in London, which is not necessarily a place where you'd expect to see those two types of birds. Maybe they've been there all along. I go to walk in that park all the time. Maybe they were always there. They probably were, but I wasn't aware of it and my eyes weren't open to it.
There's a name for that, right? I think it's called the Bader-Meinhof phenomenon, where you believe that something is happening more, or you see more of an incident because your awareness of it has increased.
Yeah, absolutely. So nice. Moving on to your next instinct. This is also about seeing something. Talk me through Lonely Doug on Vancouver Island.
Yeah, Lonely Doug is an icon. It's an iconic tree on Vancouver Island that I had no idea even existed until I went to go see it myself. So when I was living out in Vancouver last year, the west coast of Canada, I went out to Vancouver Island with a few friends who told me that there are these great untouched rainforests out there that are at risk of being logged. And I was like, okay, I mean, I'll come with you. I'll go see them. And so I did. I hopped on the ferry. I went across the Salish Sea to go see these forests. So the Pacific coast of North America, the Pacific Northwest, is a very unique ecosystem in the sense that it gets a lot of rain and it doesn't get too cold like it does in the rest of the country. So the trees are able to grow really, really big. They can grow extremely wide and extremely tall. I don't want to throw numbers out there because I'm not exactly sure, but they can definitely grow to be over 1,200 years old. Now, this is some of the oldest trees on the planet. And so when I went out there, I didn't really know what to expect. The trees that I was used to seeing were deciduous trees here in Ontario and the rest of the world that I've seen that are, you know, normal height. These trees, and I'll send you a picture, they are hundreds of feet tall and they look like skyscrapers. And when I got there, I was one of those moments where I was at a loss for words. These trees were, there were 13 of us and we all joined hands and we still could not form a circumference around the base of these trees. A lot of them are Douglas firs. A lot of them are red cedars. And we kept walking along this logging road until we came across this cut block, essentially. And a cut block is where the trees have been logged already. And it was just full of stumps, right? Bleached, dead, skeletal, wasteland looking stumps. And it was depressing because we went from this beautiful rainforest teeming with life to what was essentially a dead zone. And what stands in the middle of this dead zone is Lonely Duck. So the logger that was here with his chainsaw cutting these trees down decided to leave this one tree. He thought, this is the biggest tree out of this cut block. I'm going to spare this tree. And that tree stands today as an icon and as a symbol of the anti-old growth logging movement in Vancouver, on Vancouver Island. To see this tree, you feel a huge amount of grief, actually. You feel his loneliness. You feel the fact that he stands amongst all of his dead friends and relatives. And we know this, and I'm not exaggerating when I say that. We know that trees communicate with each other. We have evidence of this now. Mm-hmm. We have scientific evidence that underneath the earth, underneath the soil, they have fungal connections, mycelial connections that they use to connect with each other and communicate with each other. And that they actually send signals to each other when they're being cut down, when they're being hurt, when they're in a storm, or something like that. And so now that we have the scientific evidence, we know that this tree felt something, even if it was something very primal, when every single living tree around it was cut down. And you feel this sense of grief, you feel this sense of anger that something that's been around for thousands of years could be cut down in a matter of hours. That moment was what led me to speak up about anti-old growth logging in Vancouver. And I lived in Vancouver for 6 months. And we actually started a grassroots advocacy group called Old Growth Van City, where we started to bring more awareness about this to the mainland. And when we went back to Vancouver, we started organizing immediately. Protests. We organized nature walks for people to come and see big trees, old trees in the city, and then show them photos of the trees on the island that are in danger. We had organized resources to get up to the indigenous blockade up there. So this area that was at risk of being logged was called Fairy Creek. It still stands today, but we still know that logging companies are building roads, and there still is a resistance going on today up there. I wasn't a part of setting up that resistance. I can't take credit for that. That goes to the indigenous communities of that area. But we did start an advocacy group that helped relay resources from the mainland to help support the blockade. And I was so glad to be a part of this movement. I had joined late, but I was so glad I joined. And it was all because I was able to go and see Lonely Duck. I honestly fell to my knees when I first saw this tree because I had never felt so small. You feel small in front of these man-made skyscrapers and buildings and towers, but this is something that had grown all on its own. This is something that man had not touched, and something that makes you feel the true might of nature yet again, kind of like the moment with the whales. But this time it wasn't, you know, just joy, but it was also a lot of anger. And it was also a lot of, I have to do something about this. I have to join the fight against this because this is slaughter.
Why does the feeling of anger come up for you?
The feeling of anger came up because I think the way that the logging industry operates on Vancouver Island is portrayed to the public very differently from how it actually operates. So when you drive along the roads on Vancouver Island, you'll see this like lush green landscape, you know, hills and valleys. But the truth is, we actually had to venture kind of into the backcountry a little bit to find this. We found out that the logging industry has cut down almost all of the inner part of the island and has left the tourist areas intact so that tourists don't get the idea that it's being logged. So it's this sort of deception. Like when you drive along the roads, even in the interior, you're surrounded by trees. And that's because the logging companies, the logging industries there, they leave a small strip of trees just along the road so that people that are driving along can't see the destruction that they've done just behind it. All you have to do is walk about 20 feet into those trees to see these huge clear cuts, to see these massive swathes of stumps and dead trees. It's this deception that made me so angry. Because when I came back to the mainland and started talking to people about what was actually going on the island, they felt the same anger that I did because they didn't know. We all know that timber is a big part of the British Columbian economy. We just didn't know that it's that destructive. I didn't know. I thought it's, you know, the humble lumberjack just chopping away at wood and, you know, living a simple life, but it's really not. It's a lot of rampant destruction of not only trees, but the entire ecosystem that's out there. There's bears out there, there's deer out there, there's protected species out there. And there's no regard for that at all. So a lot of anger filled me in that moment because I started connecting the dots of what it meant for this forest to be eradicated, what it meant for animals, what it meant for us as people, what it meant for the indigenous people of the area, what it meant for the air we breathe. These trees have a huge role to play in filtering the water, the river that runs through, what it meant for our water, what it meant for our mental health, like for the fact that, you know, British Columbians are so proud of how beautiful their province is, of how beautiful their forests are. And they're not aware that we only have 2.7% of old growth forest intact in BC.
So this anger stems out of a deeper sense of connection with the nature and the wild intelligence of the trees, the communication systems they have in place that are actually very similar to the way that our brain works and the connections and the communications that we send to various different parts of our body. It's really similar to the way that the trees communicate with one another. And a mother tree will continue to send nutrients to the baby trees around it, even if those baby trees have been cut down. I know that's certainly the case with oak trees. I'm not sure if that's the case with all trees. But it is so much deeper than when we look at a tree and think, oh, it's just a tree. So it sounds like it's this deep instinct within you that's a reminder of we are them and they are us, and we are all part of this world together.
Exactly. I'm so glad you mentioned the concept of mother tree because a University of British Columbia professor, actually, Dr. Suzanne Simard, she's done a lot of research into this communication that we're talking about. She wrote a book called Finding Mother Tree. And I do believe it applies to trees that more than just oak. I'm not sure if it's all trees, but definitely the trees that are found in the Pacific Northwest that she did research on do communicate similar to how we do. So, you know, the same way in which I wanted to go grab my mom when I was seeing this humpback whale and its baby, this forest has a bunch of mothers that are communicating with their children, that are looking after their children just like we do. And so you're absolutely right. We're not all that different. And I think trees are underrated. How do we just walk past these massive monuments and we kind of just are super nonchalant about it? Sometimes they're tall, sometimes they're filled with pink petals. It's beautiful.
I agree with you. And sometimes they're host to other trees. So there are other trees that can live on them. And there's so much other life that grows on trees and inhabits trees, even when they have been pulled out and their roots are exposed due to a storm that's happened. There is life in death. It's a beautiful way to remind ourselves that there is something a lot bigger than just ourselves. And like you said, when you fell to your knees and you felt so small in comparison to Lonely Doug, it's feeling small in a really humble and beautiful way. If you're looking to learn techniques to tune into your own instinct and take better care of your well-being, then you'll be pleased to know I am giving all of our listeners your first month of our well-being platform Unearthed for just £1. You'll have on-demand access to over 170 yoga movement, breathwork, meditation, philosophy, Ayurveda, classes, and exclusive early access to come on our retreats. Practice anytime, on any device, and from anywhere in the world. Hit the link below to join our community today. Let's move on to your third and final moment of intuition and moment of instinct, and that is the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic in 2020.
I had never experienced anything like it before, and I'm sure it's similar for many, many other people, almost everybody. Everything and everyone came to a screeching halt. And I think I felt confused. I felt scared. There was no answers for anyone. I had, you know, relatives in India that were suffering, and I was hearing about people suffering in countries like Italy that were hit really badly. And I felt this sort of panic for people that I didn't even know. I felt like, is there a way to help these people that I can definitely not get to now that all flights are grounded? And I didn't have a job at the time. And it was just like, what can I do? There's so much death happening. There's so much suffering happening around me. And then I felt this, I don't know if you can call it clarity or if you can call it hope, but I felt like I kind of just looked up into the community around me, and I saw that everyone was coming together to help each other. Like my parents, my dad is a pediatrician, and my mom, she owns a Montessori preschool in the local community. They both work with children. And I think they were dealing with a lot of anxiety and a lot of panic from the communities that they serve, because there wasn't many answers around what COVID does to children, what effect COVID has on children. And they were doing it with so much grace, in the sense that they just kept working. They just kept going. I have this one picture from the beginning of the pandemic in which I was just sitting at the breakfast table because I had nothing else to do. This is like the first week of when it happened. And I took a picture of both of my parents as I was eating my cereal. And they were both on the phone. They were both looked like they were rushing somewhere. They were carrying like 5 bags and they were multitasking, and they looked like superheroes in that picture. And sometimes I go back to that picture just to remind myself that in times of crisis, the best thing that we can do is just do something, is to just get on our feet and actively tackle the problem rather than feeling beaten down. And I think it's okay to feel that feeling of hopelessness and feeling scared and feeling anxious, and to let that feeling pass. But once it does pass, and once you've allowed yourself to feel, take action. And I think taking action is the best thing that we can do to calm our nerves. At least that's what works for me. If I feel really helpless about a problem, the best thing I can do is one small thing that's a step in the right direction to deal with it, or something that I can check off my to-do list. And when I see that picture of my parents, they're just in action. You know, they're not sitting with their head in their hands and going, what's going on? We don't know if our work is going to be virtual. We don't know. For my dad, especially dealing with immunocompromised patients, you know, he did the best he could with the information he had, and he helped out his community. And so I look up to him a lot in many ways in my life. I think the beginning of the COVID pandemic was a defining moment for me in who my parents are and who they raised me up to be, as someone who is not idle, is not inert in the face of ambiguity, in the face of adversity, but someone who takes action, even if it's in the small ways that they can. So what I ended up doing was I joined a group, a Facebook group here in my city called Struggles of the City, and they had renamed it then COVID-19 Struggles of the City. And I was doing what I could in terms of getting groceries to old people who were too anxious to go to the grocery store for good reason. I was doing what I could in terms of helping out the homeless population at the time by volunteering with the food bank that was giving out non-perishables, that was giving out items to keep people warm, because again, this was in the dead of Canadian winter. And so I felt a little calmer. I felt a little better that, you know what? Maybe I can't help those people in Italy or those people in India that are hit really bad, but I can make a difference in my community. Since then, my thinking around not only the climate crisis, but a lot of problems that we face today in the world is that the best action you can take is getting involved with your local community. Even with the climate crisis, I can sit here and worry about the fact that the Amazon rainforest is being cut down, or I can get involved with my local river organization, Friends of the Grand River. They're making sure that our river runs clean. They're making sure their Indigenous voices are being heard. I can get involved there, and I can make a difference in my community and feel like, you know what, I'm doing my part. And I think if everybody around the world did that in their small pockets of community, we could solve a lot of problems. Instinct is the one voice that you should listen to when it comes to unprecedented situations like COVID, when it comes to unprecedented things like suddenly work has gone virtual and suddenly you can't go to school anymore. And suddenly if you're a parent, you're stuck at home with your kids. There's no rules. There were no guidelines in the early days. And even if there were, the government was changing them one week after the next. You kind of have to follow what you think is right. And you know what's best for yourself and your family and your loved ones and your community. And if you follow that instinct, I think you can't really go wrong, because if you do misstep, your instinct will guide you back on the right path.
Instinct really drives you to make change. And you're so right that maybe the time when there were no guidelines, or maybe there were, but we all knew as a collective that these were guidelines that hadn't been tried and tested before. They were guidelines that were being shared with us on the spot. And maybe that guided some of us to be more led by gut instinct and what we feel is right to do.
Yeah, I think COVID was a weird time where we were all defining for each other what we should and shouldn't be doing, when it's like, really nobody knows the answer to this. None of us know what we're doing. Like, Should I be going on a walk outside with my friends? Should I be wearing a mask when I'm doing that? Should I not be wearing a mask when I'm doing that? Should I be getting together with the Struggles of the City group, even though it's not advised that we get together, but this is to help people that are more vulnerable? There's no guidelines around that stuff. So I was just like, you know what? What are my morals? What are my values? What's my risk tolerance? What is my effect on other people? How many people am I seeing? You know, what is my responsibility towards other people? How safe can I keep myself, my family, my community? And then what can I do within those bounds?
Yeah, absolutely. And to go back to one of the things you mentioned about that final story, the vision of your parents looking like superheroes, such a lovely image. And you've spoken so much about your parents and your family, which I love, because I do the same when I share talking about yoga and my passion for it, because so much of the way that we are raised has an impact on our lives in adulthood, which sounds really self-explanatory. But I do think that sometimes in adulthood, we come back to things that in our childhood, maybe we didn't appreciate or hold on to as much as we could have done. I'd love to know if there was one thing you could say to your parents that you maybe haven't said yet, what would it be?
Oh my gosh, I feel like I'm so open with my parents. They're my best friends. I tell them everything. One thing that I worry about is living up to their example, living up to my dad's example. I feel like they do so much good and they live their lives in service of others. And that's my goal. That's my goal too. Sometimes I don't know how to get there. And sometimes I just need to take a step back and figure it out. But it's not that I want to make them proud. It's not that I have a need to make them proud. It's to prove to myself that I can be a servant to my community to the same extent that my parents have. And they've made such change. And I want to be able to say that I can do the same, just because my values are in that same bucket. My values are in the same place. And I want to be able to live up to that. And so I feel like I've been striving to do that ever since I quit my corporate job. And I was like, you know what? I don't want to be making money for a corporation that has no interest other than self-interest anymore. I want to try to make a change. And the climate space is a new field. It's a new field for any young person that's trying to get a job that helps the planet to navigate. Because honestly, our governments aren't prioritizing it as much as they should. Corporations aren't prioritizing it as much as they should. There's not as much money in these jobs as there are in other traditional jobs. So I'm trying to navigate that the best I can while keeping that true north in mind, that I want to be able to serve my community. I want to be able to make a difference for good. How do I do that while still paying the rent? How do I do that while still feeling like I'm learning new things, learning new skills? And I think it's a big balance for me that I need to perfect, but maybe I'll never get there. Maybe it's just about the journey of perfecting that balance, finding out new things along the way and making differences along the way. One thing that I hope to do is to feel like, you know what? I did live up to my parents' example. And
well, from what I know of you, you are incredibly passionate and knowledgeable about everything that you share and a true change maker. And with that mission and goal that you have, I know that you'll continue to do the work to help the communities and the planet.
Thank you, I try.
We're gonna wrap up with another instinctual check-in, close off like how we started. In this very moment, right now, how are you feeling?
I feel so much better after talking to you about these three moments in my life that I come back to in my head almost every day, but I never verbalize it. I have my little whale necklace that I see every day. I think about Lonely Doug almost all the time. Almost every time I see a tree, I think back to Doug. These moments, they define and shape my thoughts as a background, but I've never verbalized them like this. I don't know if you can tell, but I already sound way perkier than I did at the beginning of this podcast. And I feel invigorated. I feel better. I'm excited. It's snowing outside. I feel like I'm seeing everything a little bit more positively now that I've kind of put into words these things that are constantly shaping the way that I think. And now that I have a name for them, I can actually put them to use to achieve that goal, to make change. So I feel a lot more energized after this conversation with you. So thank you.
Thank you so much for sharing. Thank you for your time. It is those things in life that we come back to, the things that hold space in our mind that really energize us and inspire us to do the work that we're doing. And it's so nice to hear all the ins and outs of how those three moments of instinct have really shaped you.
It's been really cathartic almost to share it with you as well.
Amazing. Thank you so much for being part of this. And we will leave all of Krishma's details in the show notes so you can all go and support her. Thank you so much for tuning into this week's episode. If you enjoyed it, share it with someone that you know, hit subscribe and follow us for more conversations on instinct, energy, and life-changing moments. See you soon.